On the program today, this economy, sure, we do that all the time. Also, though, the Afghan economy, now and in the days to come. From American Public Media, this is Market Flash. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Wednesday today, the very first day of September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Well, it's a little bit of a jobs-a-palooza at the top of this program today with an eye toward the August jobs report that's going to come out Friday morning. And as regular listeners will know, jobs are basically the whole smash in this economy. Consumers who have jobs spend more than consumers who don't. That's the math. So with that in mind, I will mention that ADP, the private payroll processing company, announced today that its data show the economy added 374,000 jobs last month. That is a good deal fewer than people had been guessing and hoping. So into the mix now comes Walmart, which is planning to hire 20,000 people this month in the run-up to the holidays. Not to work in its stores, mind you. They will be what the biggest private employer in this economy calls supply chain associates, working in distribution and fulfillment centers, order fillers and freight handlers, Lyft drivers and the like. In an economy plagued by supply problems, Walmart says it's more important than ever to have a, quote, robust supply chain, which is true. But as Marketplace's Mariel Segarra reports, might be a little easier said than done.
Retailers are having a hard time hiring right now, especially at warehouses. In a recent survey of major retailers from the consulting firm Korn Ferry, 97% said they were having moderate or significant challenges hiring distribution center workers. That could be because of COVID and because these are not easy jobs.
Many of them involve fairly physical, demanding things like heavy lifting of products and that type of thing. And the shifts tend to be longer as well.
That's Mark Wallace at Korn Ferry. One kind of obvious solution is to make the jobs better, or more attractive at least, raise wages, make workers eligible for health insurance immediately, offer incentives. Wallace says some retailers are doing these things now.
Sign-on bonuses are fairly common, as well as attendance bonuses. So bonuses if you have good attendance. There's a lot of arguments about whether or not these actually work. But again, I think it's a sign that distribution centers are looking for different things that they can do.
We're starting to see a shift in power to workers. Angie Solanke is a director at Colliers, a real estate firm that works with retailers.
We used to see signing bonuses more in managerial and higher roles. We're starting to see signing bonuses occur at a variety of different levels. It is a employee market. Employees can demand right now what they're asking for, and the majority of the time, they're actually getting what they're asking.
And their leverage is about to grow. In the Korn Ferry survey, 53% of retailers said they were planning to open more distribution centers, and they will need staff. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, I will tell you what, traders are waiting for that jobs report as well. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Kimberly Adams filed a story for us the other day about the return on investment of the $14 or maybe $15 billion that was spent along the Gulf Coast after Katrina. In making the aftermath of Hurricane Ida, bad as it was, not as bad as it could have been. Here then is another story on that theme from Andy Euler, except it's about money not spent. You've heard about the power outages, right? About electricity poles being blown down and that transmission tower, the big one that somehow wound up in the Mississippi River. So Euler got to wondering, and maybe you have too, I don't know, why don't utilities just bury power lines in places where natural disasters tend to cause a lot of damage? Here's Andy.
So there's a relatively simple answer to why power lines in places like the Gulf Coast aren't underground.
We haven't done it yet because it's expensive.
That's Megan Lawson. She's an economist at the land use nonprofit Headwaters Economics. She says, depending on where you're talking about burying lines, the costs could be 5 or 10 times the cost of wiring them above ground. But despite that upfront cost, in some places, it still might make sense.
We also need to be looking at the intensity and frequency of a lot of these natural disasters is increasing.
Which she says means we can't just rely on natural disaster cost history, but we need to be projecting those costs into the future. That's not an easy task. Peter Larson is a department head of the Berkeley Lab in the Department of Energy. He says the cost-benefit calculation is going to be very region-specific.
So if you have a community that has a pretty mild climate and, they get storms every once in a while, then it doesn't always make sense to underground. But in places that are continuously bombarded with hurricanes or wind events, those are good candidates for undergrounding.
We have a pretty good idea of how much it costs utilities to fix their physical damage after a hurricane, repairing lines and so on. But Benjamin Leibowitz at the University of Texas says that's only part of the story.
We found that relatively little effort has gone into calculating the broader costs of these power interruptions to customers, to the economy, and to society at large.
So he says it could be that the benefits of grid-hardening interventions like undergrounding power lines are being underestimated. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Podcast. That's it. That's the call out. Podcast. Check it out. One of the many, many things still unclear now that the United States is out of Afghanistan is what's going to happen to its economy. Even before Americans left, the Afghan economy was not strong. More than 47% of the population lived below the national poverty line over there in 2020, and foreign aid and imports were critical to making what did work, work. So we have gotten Asad Ejaz Butt on the phone. He's a macroeconomist in Pakistan now, specializing in that region. And we wanted to ask what is happening now and what might happen eventually. Asad, thanks for coming on.
Hi, Kai. Thank you for having me.
If I am in Afghanistan and I'm trying to go buy a loaf of bread, how does all of this macroeconomic stuff affect me? Am I seeing inflation? Are prices going up? Can I get cash if I need cash?
You would be able to get hold of cash, but that cash is losing its value very, very quickly, which in more formal terms is called inflation. And of particular concern is the food inflation. Of course, even though agriculture is still 25% of the or 26% of the Afghan economy, yet they depend enormously on food imports from Pakistan, from other regions of the world. So those food imports have to be financed by the dollar, and the dollar is no more there. So inflation is going to rise enormously in the next few months.
Setting aside the politics of it, right, bearing in mind that you're an economist, do you think the Taliban is equipped to manage an economy that is right now in crisis, and as you've written, close to collapse?
I fear not. Governance is very sophisticated business, and if I don't see, the expertise and the skills within the Taliban ranks to run an economy, to make economic policies, they would have to rely on external sources. I don't think the Taliban, the current setup of the Taliban, has the expertise to make economic policies or govern, the executive branches of the government, which would be ultimately responsible for running the economy.
It occurs to me as we're having this conversation that I've asked you about timing and timelines once or twice. This is actually a generational problem, right?
Yes. So I don't think the Taliban economy would be on its feet, in the short term. And Afghanistan is a mess right now. And if Afghanistan has to stand on its feet economically, it would have to be a concerted effort. As I believe, things will have to start from scratch. especially in the rural Afghanistan, which is massively underdeveloped. So these bigger cities like Kandahar, Herat, Kabul, they are still, you know, reasonably developed. But regardless of that, I think a lot of reconstruction, economic reconstruction, has to take place. And it has to be a concerted effort of all the regional forces, including, you know, a large role to play by Pakistan, India, Bangladesh, these neighboring countries, to bring Afghanistan back on its feet.
So in the next, I don't know, 6 to 12 months to try to ameliorate the suffering that the Afghan people are going to feel almost no matter what, but in the next 6 to 12 months, what do you think the next step should be?
The Taliban government, they're, I think, already talking to the Pakistan government. They've had some conversations with leadership in Pakistan, of course, some behind the doors. Then, of course, some investments have to go into the economy to continue the economy. So I think in the short run, what the Taliban's would do is, or what they should do is, to sort of infuse some confidence in the local business community to ensure that, you know, they don't lose a lot of jobs. The business sector continues to function. And there is absolutely no capital flight, because whatever capital is residing in the economy must continue to reside in the economy. I think in the long term, they would have to ultimately rely on the international community, on these multilateral agencies. And how supportive would these multilateral agents, with the Americans gone now, how supportive would the multilateral agencies be is something yet to be seen.
Yeah. Regional macroeconomist, also an economic journalist, Asad Jazbut, we got him in Islamabad, Pakistan. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you, Kai, for having me. Thank you.
Coming up,
we aren't even open on Saturdays and Sundays.
When the customers you need just aren't coming. First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's down 48 points today, about a tenth percent, 35,312. The NASDAQ gained 50 points, 0.3%, 15,309. S&P 500 was flat, 45.24 is where the S&P landed today. We heard from Mueller about millions of people around the Gulf Coast still being without power, gas, and water. The main energy firm down there, Entergy, up 1.7%. Georgia-based utility Southern Company up 1.1%. For Marielle, that to prep for the holiday season, Walmart plans to hire 20,000 supply chain workers if they can find them. Walmart down 0.2% today. Amazon and Costco both picked up about 0.2%. The CDC, Centers for Disease Control, is urging unvaccinated Americans not to travel this Labor Day weekend. Thus, some related stocks. United sank 0.6%. American Airlines dipped 1.5%. Hyatt down about 0.3%. Bond prices went up. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note down to 1.29%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Rent is due today, or maybe you've got a couple of three more days, but you get my point. And for the millions of people who are behind on their rent or struggling to make it, federal protections against eviction are no more. Some cities and states do still have their own bans in place, yes, but the public health ramifications of all those potential evictions are real. That's the gist of a study out this week in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Marketplace's Samantha Fields has that one.
In the early days of the pandemic, in March and April of 2020, 43 states and D.C. banned evictions to keep COVID from spreading.
I'm now convinced that this public health policy worked.
Sebastian Sandoval Olascoaga is a doctoral student in urban economics and policy at MIT and one of the researchers on the JAMA study. In the 26 states that allowed evictions to resume before the federal moratorium went into effect last summer, the risk of getting COVID nearly doubled compared to states that kept eviction bans in place.
When we think about eviction, we tend to think of the people that are more at risk because they will be homeless. But what we found is that not just them are at risk of being diagnosed after this happens, but also the ones that are not at risk of being evicted.
because it is a communicable disease, the more that COVID is out there, the more of the population that is carrying COVID, the more that it is a risk to anyone.
Dr. Asindar Venkatramani at the University of Pennsylvania also worked on this study. He says the risk of getting COVID increased most for people with pre-existing conditions or who live in low-income areas.
Some patients will say, I have to work 3 jobs and I have to take the subway. I have no choice. I don't have the option to not work.
With the more contagious Delta variant now circulating, Megan Hatch, a professor of urban studies at Cleveland State University, is concerned because there are also studies that show
places with highest eviction rates also tend to have the lowest vaccination rates. So we're seeing all these things compounding.
Several states and cities do still have eviction bans in place. Most don't. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
For the last 7 or so years, we have been making regular calls to Butte, Montana, to the manager's office at the Butte Plaza Mall, where Alana Furco is in charge. And there have been some ups and downs in the mall in those 7 years, to be honest. It's been nice to have the regulars coming by, Alana's told us, the mall walkers trying to get some exercise. But big department store anchor tenants have left, and there's been dealing with COVID safety rules as well. It's been a couple of months, 6, I think, actually, since we have talked to the manager of the Butte Plaza Mall, so we have gotten her back on the phone today. Hey, Alana.
Hi, Kai. How are you? I hope healthy and sassy.
Healthy and sassy. That's the way people describe me. How are you? You're always usually good, except I remember last time you kind of maybe weren't so good, right? You were a little glum.
You know, and I'm trying to keep myself out of that, but I do have COVID concerns. I still have concerns for my community. But yeah, I try to do my best every day to stay as positive as I can, but I do have worries.
Tell me about them. First of all, I mean, you're okay, right? Are you healthy and safe?
You know, I am. I am vaccinated. All right. But every day it is stressful for people who, and I don't know why they feel so emboldened to share with me that they are not vaccinated when they're out in the mall. But that does stress me out a little bit. We need to keep our people healthy so that we can stay open. If somebody does get sick or is exposed to COVID, then there's the whole terror of half the people around you being quarantined. And that's tough because you lose 10 days to 2 weeks of work.
Yeah.
That's frustrating.
Yeah, no, I'm sure it is. What about the business of the Butte Plaza Mall? I mean, are people coming in to do back to school shopping? What's the department store situation? Do you still have not have an anchor store? What's going on there?
I still do not have an anchor store, but it has been an amazing season. The tourists have been great. Back to school shopping has been really strong. I was just visiting with the farmers market in Uptown Butte, and they're thinking that they want to carry that forth for a winter market, but not something you can do outside.
Yeah, no.
So maybe we're going to be the home of their winter market. There just seems to be a strong sense of community. Maybe COVID brought that to light. Maybe a lot of us were just caught up in the convenience and not realizing that we have neighbors that provide some of the things that we've been relying on the big box stores for. We'll see. I hope I'm worried about COVID. We will follow any of the recommendations of the local health department in limiting the amount of people in the mall, limiting gatherings, that kind of a thing, just so that we can be as safe as we can right now.
You sound, I can't decide which one it is. You sound either scared or really tired.
Excuse me. I think I'm both. I'm really tired, Kai. I'm tired.
Yeah.
I am. I apologize.
No. That's
lucky. I'm wary. I am. I'm just full of worry and I'm tired.
Yeah. Well, it's been a long haul, especially...
I am an extrovert.
Yeah.
I love people, but I'm struggling to like some of them.
Yeah. Yeah. I did not mean to get you down, especially because you are always a little...
No, that's okay.
You're always a little upbeat note on the program, but it can't be that way when it's not. And so...
No.
It won't be, and that's okay.
I am pretty raw.
Yeah.
And I'll just share something personal. I lost my 20-year work husband in April to COVID.
Oh.
COVID is very real to me. It is very real to me.
Yeah.
And I've seen too many people sick, and they don't have to be.
No, they don't. Alana, you take good care.
Yes, and I'm sorry to be a downer. My apologies.
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. You just be you. Okay?
Thank you.
All right.
I appreciate that. And thank you. Thank you for you being you. I appreciate that.
Well, we've been talking to each other for a long time now. We've been talking to each other for a long time.
We have, yes.
And maybe I'll get up there. Montana's a beautiful place. Maybe I can walk with your people once I get up there.
we'll have a special walking time for you.
All right. We'll talk to you soon. Take care of yourself, all right?
You as well. Stay healthy.
The labor market story of this pandemic is complicated. We know that. Women and what the past year and a half has meant for them. Work from home for those lucky enough to have been able to do that. And essential workers who've been working everywhere really but home. And as we've been reporting, people in those service jobs, the hotels and the restaurants, they have lost both working hours and a whole lot of financial ground. A new working paper out this week lays out how that happened and what comes next as working remotely for more and more people stretches on indefinitely. Marketplace's Caroline Champlin has that story.
Modern Coffee in downtown Oakland is right next to BART stops, meant to lure in commuters on the hunt for caffeine. When they stopped coming into offices last year, the three cafes shut down.
We had 22 employees, all of whom were laid off when this happened.
That's one of Modern Coffee's owners, Kristen Nelson. She's reopened two locations, but only a few customers are back working nearby.
In fact, it's so quiet in downtown Oakland on the weekends that we aren't even open on Saturdays and Sundays. And basically trying to serve the most number of people we can with the fewest number of hours.
Nelson's watching local companies' back-to-work plans closely because the current situation won't be sustainable. UC San Diego professor Fabian Eckert, one of the authors on that economic study, says that's one of the takeaways from his findings.
I wonder whether companies like Apple are kind of taking into account that whatever they ask their workers to do is actually also going to impact the very local consumer service industry.
Since May of this year, the number of people working remotely because of the pandemic has fallen. But Glassdoor chief economist Daniel Zhao will be studying the newest jobs report this coming Friday to see if that ticks back up.
The Delta variant means that companies are pulling back on their reopening plans.
The question, Zhao says, is whether companies will stay flexible. Meanwhile, workers that depend on the lunch, coffee, and commuter crowd won't have that option. I'm Caroline Champlin for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, an update to an item from a couple of weeks ago, I think it was, which I prefaced with, please, y'all don't do this. There had been, at the time, anecdotal reports that Costco was limiting toilet paper purchases because people had been stockpiling, and I said, don't do that. Well, today from the Wall Street Journal, this item, Procter & Gamble, the biggest toilet paper maker in this economy, is running its toilet paper plants 24/7
to meet demand. I am begging you, please, just don't. All right, we're going, but here is your moment of economic context. I mentioned this the other day, but the numbers keep falling. The TSA says 1.3 million people passed through its checkpoints yesterday. That is the fewest people flying since May. With all respect to Jay Powell, it is the Delta variant that is still in charge of this economy. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Jay Siebold, Liana Squillace, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Torrado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.